I next met with Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy, and to begin, she commented on the use of androgen receptor antagonist in metastatic triple-negative breast cancer.
I think it's a very important strategy. In triple-negative, it appears that somewhere between 12%, perhaps as high as 30% of triple-negatives have 10% or more nuclear staining for the androgen receptor. And we had already seen a proof of concept trial done by Tiffany Traina of bicalutamide, 150 milligrams daily, a 20% clinical benefit rate in heavily pretreated patients. So that was interesting. And then more recently, we've seen the much more powerful pure antagonist of the androgen receptor, enzalutamide, single agent in this population. And we saw a more impressive response rate, clinical benefit rate, over 30%, closer to 39%, as I recall. Quite impressive, you know, even a heavily pretreated group of patients. I think the proof of concept is there. I was very interested in the enzalutamide because they have the AR predict gene expression assay, because that's what we really need. We'd be able to take these patients who have AR positive, triple negative, and say, well, which patients really have AR as a driving transcription factor in this disease? And the AR predict seemed to be better than just the 10% cutoff for nuclear staining. Having said that, if you look carefully at Tiffany's slides from ASCO, you see that there is a nice correlation, at least in my opinion, looking at the percentage of cells positive in the nuclei for the AR compared to the AR predict. And it seemed like the patients that were AR predict positive, for the most part, had pretty high levels, not just 10%. They were up at, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90% AR positive. But there were some patients who were AR predict positive that were lower levels of the nuclear AR staining. So I think that once we have a little bit more data about who to aim the enzalutamide at, both in the triple negative NEAL, but also in the 50% of the ER negative HER2 positives that are AR positive, I think we really, in my opinion, really need to start doing trials earlier line metastatic disease, and I think very importantly, getting this into the adjuvant setting for patients, selected patients with higher risk ER negative HER2 positive disease and triple negative disease, node positive disease. I think there's kind of a bit of urgency to it, Neil. I've seen enough clinical activity that I'm a believer in this.
So could you talk a little more about the AR predict assay?
It's a gene expression profile. It is an assay that came out, an iteration of the original work done at Memorial Sloan Kettering by Dr. Traina's colleague, who first showed with gene expression profiling that there was a group of these triple negative cell lines that looked very similar in terms of their androgen receptor downstream gene expression and signaling to prostate cancers, where we see, of course, AR very much involved in gene activation as a transcription factor. So I believe it's an outgrowth of that research identifying these downstream signatures from the AR that shows active transcription by the AR in prostate cancer. And lo and behold, it's also in breast cancer.
So I asked you, because I was curious how this really plays out clinically, if you could present a patient in your practice who actually was part of this study looking at enzalutamide, or I assume she was in the study, but this 45-year-old lady. Can you talk about her?
Yes, this is a very lovely 45-year-old Asian woman who had presented with early-stage triple-negative breast cancer, had received standard adjuvant AC and paclitaxel chemotherapy, and then unfortunately developed sclerotic-only metastatic breast cancer to her bones. She may have had a little low-grade adenopathy, as I recall, too, Neil, but it was mainly bones. It presented with a rib metastasis, quite painful, but it was interesting, and it was sclerotic, which, as you know, is unusual. And she did receive a first-line platinum-based chemotherapy with modest response. She got some benefit, had some platinum-based therapy stopped, and then unfortunately progressed, you know, approximately 4 to 6 months later. And she had had her original breast cancer assayed for the androgen receptor and indeed was quite positive, as I recall. I want to say she was in the 30 to 40% of nuclei positive for the androgen receptor by IHC. And so she went on the enzalutamide clinical trial, and she did well on it. She had improvement in bone pain, and she had a stability of her disease with, you know, the sclerotic bone metastases are difficult to interpret radiologically, but she did not have any progression of disease. It appeared that, you know, clinically she was improved, and she was on that therapy for approximately 10 months' time. She definitely was one of the patients who achieved clinical benefit. So that was very good. You know, you do wonder what the resistance mechanisms were in her cancer. Not all of her cancer cells were AR positive. She's gone on to subsequent clinical trial therapy since that time, but she certainly benefited. And I guess we just have to wonder, women like her, had they had access to enzalutamide after their adjuvant ACT type chemotherapy, could we have made more progress against her breast cancer? But she was the woman that I treated on study who was a clinical benefit. I had other patients on trial as well, but she was the patient of mine who did the best.
So it's unfortunately pretty easy to run out of options in triple negative breast cancer. What recommendations are you making right now to general oncologists in practice about this? Should they consider some type of androgen assay? Which assay should they use? Is there any point in trying to attempt enzalutamide? I've had oncologists ask me about bicalutamide being, you know, less expensive. What's your thoughts about that?
I do. As you point out, Neil, we have so few options. And I do think the clinical cancer research paper by Trena is very helpful in terms of, you know, just a peer-reviewed publication for bicalutamide. I do recommend that triple-negative patients, particularly if they have the so-called clinical phenotype of AR-driven triple-negative disease, and that, in my opinion, is these are often lymphatically seeking. These are patients who present with multiple positive lymph nodes, lots of lymphovascular invasion. They often will present with sclerotic-type bone metastasis. It can be kind of a miliary picture. It looks more like prostate cancer than breast cancer, but it tends to be nodal disease or bony sclerotic disease, can be some lung metastasis. In fact, Tiffany's poster from San Antonio last year had some really nice pictures of two patients who responded, CT scans of patients who responded in lung and mediastinum. So definitely pulmonary metastasis. I think this one's super interesting, Neil. I think this is a definite stay tuned. I think that we're on the threshold of a whole nother therapeutic opportunity.
So sort of circling back to triple negative disease and this lady, a couple other questions. One, just flashing on the fact you mentioned she had pretty much only bone mets. Have you ever used radium-223, which of course is approved in prostate cancer, in breast cancer? And is there a logic to it? Or are there trials looking at it?
It's a really interesting question, Neil. I believe there is a trial going on. I think it's European-based. I'm not aware that it's going on in the U.S. I have not had the opportunity to use it myself. You know, as you know, we do worry still about some myelosuppression, although I know the alpha inhibitors, you know, the path length of the radiation is much, much less, and you're going to get much less myelosuppression. And I think the prostate data are very interesting. I believe it improved survival, as I recall,
right,
or something.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very important hypothesis. And you really wonder, Neil, particularly we could take these patients here who have node-positive disease, triple-negative, AR-positive. You know, if you do careful thin-slice MRIs on those patients through their spine, you know what? You're going to find some small-volume metastatic disease in these patients. And, you know, we just know that they're at very high risk for recurrence. And, gosh, it'd be really interesting to consider a trial, you know, of the radium in those patients. So I'm glad that there is a trial going on in metastatic breast cancer. I've not heard anything about preliminary data, but I think it's a really important hypothesis for these cancers that really are bone dominant in their metastatic patterns.
Another triple negative question, and one that I'm asking, it seems like in every tumor nowadays, is checkpoint inhibitors. We now are starting in the last year see data with anti-PD-1 antibodies in breast cancer, triple-negative disease. Can you talk about what we've learned and what you think about it?
Well, it's obviously very, very exciting with now two of the anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 agents looking quite you know, the proof of concept, I will say, heavily pretreated patients, about 19% objective response rate, and some of the responses quite durable, more durable, certainly, than we would ever see with chemotherapy and heavily pretreated patients, no question. I would say what sounds to be excellent tolerability, the safety issues in terms of, you know, serious pneumonitis, colitis, just not really seeing it, you know, the way that you can, for example, with ipilimumab, both the pembrolizumab as well as the MPDL looking identically active, one against PD-1, the pembrolizumab, PD-L1, the MPDL. Both of the trials focusing on PD-L1 positive metastatic triple-negative breast cancer patients. Having said that, that's not clear that that's required. And subsequent trials that are now ongoing are looking both at cohorts that are PD-L1 negative as well as PD-L1 positive to really nail down that question. The issue, Neil, is that so far it's really been a minority of patients who have benefited, and even just a smaller subset of those who have benefited durably, albeit these are heavily pretreated patients. You know, but again, in even the non-small cell and melanoma populations, these patients who got tremendous benefit sometimes were very heavily pretreated. What I've heard from some scientists is that there may be a correlation between expression of PD-L1 and proliferation. So I have it in my head as a hypothesis that it's these breast cancers that are highly genomically unstable. They have homologous recombination defects. They may have mismatch repair because, as you know, there's a subset of triple negatives that have mismatch repair problems. So they have a high mutational load. They're highly genomically unstable. Many of them are highly proliferative. And I've been told that that's the context that the anti-PD-L1 is really expressed. So I think that our best opportunity with these agents is going to be to get them in less heavily pretreated patients and, frankly, to get them in, you know, as close to upfront as we possibly can in the metastatic setting and eventually in the neoadjuvant setting before we have already killed off with our chemotherapy agents these cells that are highly proliferative and maybe somewhat chemotherapy sensitive, leaving behind the really drug-resistant, less highly proliferative mesenchymal-type cells where they may not be so PD-L1 positive. So that's just a hypothesis that I'm thinking about, Neil. I think we're just going to really need to get a better handle on which patients to aim these agents at, but we need a larger experience. And I'm excited we're opening up the phase 2 trial of pembrolizumab next week at Baylor Sammons, where I work. I'm very excited about it because everybody is able to get the agent. There's a cohort that's PD-L1 negative. There's a cohort that's PD-L1 positive. Everybody has to get a biopsy to go on trial, phase 2 trial, you know, no limit on priors, et cetera. Very nice trial. Looking forward to it tremendously. It's going to be a large trial, so we're going to get a lot of data in terms of which patients really benefit. So certainly very exciting.
This is just triple negative?
Yes, triple negative.
You mentioned MSI high, and I didn't realize there are patients with breast cancer. I mean, obviously, we saw some really exciting data. It was mainly in GI cancers, colon cancer. Is this the same MSI high that responded to anti-PD-1 agents?
You know, there was a paper, you know, there's a literature on mismatch repair and MSI high breast cancer. I looked into it some years ago, and there's clearly a group of such patients. And then a very nice paper came out of the Dana-Farber about 5-6 years ago, really characterizing MSI high versus low early stage breast cancers and looking at the outcome of these early breast cancers. And they had a poor prognosis. The MSI high patients did poorly. It wasn't exactly MSI high, Neil. They were using immunohistochemistry against mismatch repair enzymes. So it was really more at the enzyme level they were looking at for the mismatch repair enzymes and not the readout of MSI high. And there's a literature, for example, Neil, that shows that these kinds of cancers are more sensitive to irinotecan than to 5-FU-based regimens, et cetera. So there is a literature. It's just never been exploited in breast cancer. But I remember in particular reading that 20% of triple negative breast cancers were mismatch repair deficient. That's a number that sticks in my head. I made a bunch of slides on this topic some years ago. And I think, Neil, at the end of the day, we're going to have to know for these various triple negatives and eventually ER positives as well, but particularly triple negatives, what's the mechanism of DNA repair deficiency? Is it MSI? Is it, you know, homologous recombination? Because I think we're going to have to really exploit that, potentially with checkpoint inhibitors and also potentially with the cytotoxic agents that we deploy. So I think it's a super important area.
Now, this phase two trial that's about to open, is that just triple negative?
Yes, just triple negative, accelerated approval for pembrolizumab.
And outside a clinical trial setting, what are your thoughts about the possibility? I mean, the two anti-PD-1 antibodies are approved in, you know, melanoma and lung cancer. Would you attempt to access it? If a patient said, I'll pay for it, would you use it?
Yes, I would. You know, we can get PD-L1 expression performed by IHC, and several good commercial diagnostic laboratories have those assays available. And if a patient's breast cancer was PD-L1 positive and she had triple negative breast cancer, and we could either get it approved off-label, which is not likely, or the patient said, I would like to pay for this myself, yes, Neil, I would.
So again, kind of getting back to this lady, we've talked about a lot of different experimental approaches to triple negative disease, including the one that she actually received. But I'm also curious, sort of outside a trial setting, where you are today in terms of sequencing chemotherapy and metastatic triple negative disease, particularly in the very common situation that this lady found herself in, having received a prior anthracycline taxane.
Well, Neil, I was very impressed with the data that Steven Isikoff presented from the Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium Trial 9. It's just recently been published as well, looking at physicians' choice of single-agent cisplatin or carboplatin as first or second-line therapy for metastatic triple-negative breast cancer only. And there was a small cohort, about 10% of first-line only. This did not hold in the second line, patients who went into complete response, more so with cisplatin 75 per meter every 3 weeks than carbo, AUC of 6. But there were some with carbo this happened to as well. They went into CR, Neil, and they stayed there indefinitely. They're 3, 4, 5 plus years out. I have some of those patients in my practice. And just parenthetically, I'm very impressed in that particular setting. I have two patients in durable CRs with nab-paclitaxel at 220 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks with cisplatin 75 that are in durable CRs with metastatic triple negative. So I'm doing a preoperative study of the nab-paclitaxel every 3 weeks, high dose, with cisplatin 75. That's never been looked at in breast cancer. I'm starting a small pilot trial to also look at metabolomics in locally advanced triple negatives to look at the PAF CR rate. So whether or not the nab-paclitaxel is adding to the cisplatin, I can't tell, but I want to take a look at the PAF CR rate. I'm impressed. But I think Isikoff's data are very important. It is unheard of to get these durable, multi-year, potentially permanent CRs in metastatic triple negative. So I think we must pay attention to that when we're choosing our first-line therapy. And, you know, these patients, I think, I asked Dr. Isikoff, I said, did any of these have liver disease? The answer is no. These were lung metastasis, lymph node metastases. These are your more classic basals that have a highly proliferative disease and triple negative and sort of a basal metastatic pattern. We certainly need more data, but I am certainly recommending a platinum, cisplatin-based approach in such patients. I myself am adding the nab-paclitaxel in there because of my personal experience with it. So that's, I think, really an important strategy to consider. You know, outside of a platinum-based regimen, I mean, one can use a gem-carbo approach. A lot of docs do that, and I think it's not unreasonable at all. I think that's, you know, a palliative regimen. I was just thinking, Neil, in our Inibrib trial with gemcitabine carboplatin, there were a subset of patients with first-line, good performance status, triple-negative breast cancer that did unbelievably well with just plain gemcitabine carboplatin. It's probably one of the reasons that the study was less positive in the first-line than in the second-line setting. So even gem-carbo is not unreasonable, but, you know, it's the Isikoff paper that I think really puts this concept on the map, that there's this subset. So I think we should use the Isikoff data in this regard. Certainly, paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel remain very important options in triple-negative breast cancer. As you know, there's a whole bunch of clinical trials going on with either nab-paclitaxel you know, plus minus the MPDL, for example, the checkpoint inhibitor, or there's a whole host of trials going on with paclitaxel plus minus novel agent, AKT inhibitor, alisertib, for example, and a host of others. So obviously, we think about that quite a bit. Eribulin is another proven non-cross-resistant agent in triple-negative breast cancer, and it's one that I think I tend to use fairly early, either second or third line. In triple-negative breast cancer, I think that if a patient has had ACT, I'm not enthusiastic about going back to a taxane. If they've had a platinum, for example, first line, I'll go on to eribulin. Second line, the study 301 by Kaufman and colleagues really, I think, support eribulin as a second line agent in triple-negative breast cancer, showing a 5-month improvement in survival compared to capecitabine in that clinical trial. You know, those are the data sets, I would say, Neil, where we have the level one evidence. Oh, I have to add ixabebolone and capecitabine combination as a level one evidence. No improvement in survival, but improvement in progression-free survival. That's another option for patients. I think I push that later line because of the toxicity involved with neuropathy and just the combination with capecitabine, hand, foot, et cetera. But it is a level one evidence option. But, you know, Neil, we're kind of out of good data at this point in standard practice from a phase two clinical trial. I will highlight a regimen that I use commonly and get some palliation from, which is daily oral cyclophosphamide, 50 milligrams daily, with methotrexate, 2.5 milligrams. It's a couple of different ways you can do it, either Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 3 days a week, or BID, 2 days out of seven. And there was just a very interesting adjuvant trial presented at ASCO in triple-negative breast cancer patients after they had finished standard adjuvant chemotherapy being randomized to this low-dose oral daily cyclophosphamide methotrexate regimen CM versus not, showing a survival advantage with the, as I recall, survival, I believe it was, it could have been progression-free, but I thought it was survival in the adjuvant setting with the cyclophosphamide methotrexate. And I have found, even in the setting of leptomeningeal disease with triple-negative breast cancer patients after whole-brain radiation therapy, you know, do you go with the IT therapy, which is terribly toxic? And I have not had a convincing clinical benefit from IT chemotherapy in leptomeningeal disease from triple-negative, but I have had convincing clinical benefit in a number of patients with the cyclophosphamide methotrexate. The Dana-Farber-Hal Burstein published on this, Colleoni in Europe published on this in Annals of Oncology some years back. There's a decent number of phase two trials that have looked at this combination. I find that to be a reasonable palliative option. I do come in sometimes with some irinotecan in these patients. And then, Neil, you know, there's a group of these triple negatives that have patterns of metastasis that remind you more of ER-positive breast cancer, bone, liver. I think the androgen receptor may be playing an important role here, and I do find that coming in with taxanes, whether it be docetaxel, nab-paclitaxel, paclitaxel, can be beneficial to these patients. Capecitabine can benefit these patients. So there certainly are options that we use. The big problem we have is it's very difficult to get the durable responses that really lead to improvement in patients' quality of life and survival.
It's interesting you mentioned your interest in combining cisplatin with nab-paclitaxel. You know, finally, the CALGB metastatic trial that Hope Rugo did was published in the JCO, which, you know, did not show a benefit for nab-paclitaxel compared to paclitaxel and purported to show more toxicity, although the dose was a little bit up. What's your thinking in terms of why you do use nab-paclitaxel in your practice?
So, with regard to weekly nab-paclitaxel, I use that, Neil, predominantly as a toxicity reduction strategy to avoid chronic steroid use. As you know, there is a preclinical literature as well as some clinical trials going on looking at glucocorticoid receptor blockade. There's a trial going on with mifepristone right now, which is approved for Cushing's disease. It's a GR antagonist in combination with. There's been a trial done with nab-paclitaxel. There's a trial going on right now with eribulin. Because Suzanne Kahnsen has shown that steroids signal down through GR in triple-negative breast cancers and lead to drug resistance. But also the chronic steroid use weekly with regular paclitaxel is very, very fatiguing for patients over time. They hate it. So I use nab-paclitaxel to avoid steroids, but also because I think you get less peripheral neuropathy. Our clinical trial that we did, a big phase two experience in later line metastatic breast cancer, we looked at 100 per meter. We looked at 125 per meter weekly, three on, one off with the nab-paclitaxel. We only came up with an 8% grade 3 peripheral neuropathy rate with 100 per meter. And that's way less than Andy Seidman showed earlier line. I believe he was at 19% grade 3 peripheral neuropathy with paclitaxel at 80 per meter. So I think I get more mileage out of the weekly. Now, when I really want to try for a high-dose platinum approach, you know, the cisplatin 75 per meter, and I really want to give, you know, excellent tumor penetration and go after that mitotic spindle and go after and exploit the deficit in double-strand DNA repair, there I turn to the higher dose nab-paclitaxel. That's my experience. We are going to do a preoperative trial, as I mentioned, of the combination of nab-paclitaxel 220 per meter with the cisplatin 75 per meter. And I turned there, Neil, because of data showing just overall better efficacy of the higher dose nab-paclitaxel. This is the on-label way that the agent was actually approved. And frankly, Neil, over the years, we've had nab for a long time, and I've seen some of these remarkable responses to higher dose every three-weekly nab-paclitaxel in triple-negative breast cancers, surprisingly. And so I'm sort of dusting off that hypothesis, if you will. I think we all went over to the weekly nab-paclitaxel in the palliative setting, which I still do myself for the most part. But in this triple negative patients that have, you know, potentially highly chemotherapy sensitive breast cancer, I am using the nab in that context, you know, to try to get these patients into a complete response.
What did you think about the German neoadjuvant trial that seemed to demonstrate greater efficacy in the pre-op setting with nab versus paclitaxel?
Yes, that really was very interesting. And I think that it's a very encouraging trial. I believe we're waiting on the results to see the results at the 125. You know, they started at the 150 on the nab, and the data were reported with the combination of the 150. Patients started with the 150 and the patients started with the 125. We need to see the PAF-CR rates on those that started with the 125 because the 150 turned out to be pretty neurotoxic and not feasible to keep it going for the, I believe, 12 weeks that they were doing it for. So we need to see that 125. But I think that was a very interesting observation and one that I think we may want to give some careful consideration to. You know, personally, I'd like to see the 125 data, and I'd like to see an accelerated approval strategy on that with the FDA's new way of looking at accelerated approval based on PAF-CR, because I believe it was about a 10% delta improvement in PAF-CR rate with the nab-paclitaxel compared to the paclitaxel. So if the 125, which we can get in for these patients, really holds up in terms of that delta, I believe we're going to be seeing some of those data at San Antonio, is my understanding, Neil.
So you were mentioning eribulin. I want to hear about your patient that you wanted to present. But first, I see that you've been involved with some studies looking at eribulin in the first-line setting, both in HER2-positive and HER2-negative breast cancer. Can you talk about what was seen there and whether you think there's any future for this drug earlier on?
Yes, eribulin, we did a phase two trial, first-line metastatic, a combination of ER-positive and triple-negative patients. They were HER2-negative. Standard dose schedule, eribulin, first line, response rate 30 to 35%, a little bit higher in the ER positive than the triple negative, median PFS, reasonable in the order of 6-7 months in the ER positive, 4-5 months in the triple negative, more neuropathy than you saw later line because the patients received more eribulin, first line, than they do later line. Manageable agent. You know, Neil, there's a phase three going on comparing first-line eribulin to weekly paclitaxel in HER2-negative patients as we speak. So we'll see whether that is an agent that will have a benefit over regular weekly paclitaxel in a subset of HER2-negative patients. In the HER2-positive patients, we did trastuzumab without pertuzumab with standard dose schedule eribulin first-line metastatic and had a very respectable response rate, as I recall, about 70%. It's published now. Median PFS was 11 and a half months or so. Quite nice. Again, more neuropathy because these patients received the eribulin quite a long period of time, so we had more grade 3 neuropathy than you see later line. That's manageable with holding and dose reduction. Highly active agent, rivals any of our other strategies for first-line metastatic. As you know, we use a Cleopatra design now with a taxane, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, first-line metastatic. So not clear that we will see eribulin first-line HER2-positive, Neil, but certainly I think that trial said, hey, the eribulin now is another agent we can combine with trastuzumab safely, effectively, and it's something that has given me license now to use it later line HER2-positive metastatic disease.
So why don't we finish out talking about very briefly some of the other patients you brought in here today, and maybe we can start out with this 50-year-old lady who got eribulin and trastuzumab.
Yeah, she's one of many that are very similar, Neil, to this. And these patients have had HER2-amplified disease, some ER-negative HER2-amplified disease, heavily pretreated patients. The one I wanted to tell you about initially, but I have several just like her, ER-positive, HER2-amplified, had heavily pretreated, had endocrine therapies, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, everolimus, multiple chemotherapy agents, bone liver metastasis, happened to know she has a PIK3CA mutation. Very nice, robust, durable response, very late line to eribulin and trastuzumab. The issue you run into over time is neuropathy. You can tweak the dose and schedule of eribulin. Neil, if you run into myelosuppression, want to mention, we're doing a study now of eribulin at the 1.4 milligrams per meter squared every 2 weeks, because a lot of docs, sometimes in the heavily pretreated patients, can't get the day 8 in. And so they kind of are de facto going to a day and every other week schedule. So we're doing a phase 2 trial of that prospectively. But you can, with trastuzumab, if patients are responding, you can get down to the 1.1 milligrams per meter squared day 1, day 8, or you could go to an every other week and utilize pegfilgrastim if you wanted to. But these patients, you can manage the myelosuppression, but what builds up over time is neuropathy, sensory, but also I am finding motor neuropathy over time. But these patients, sometimes you can really rescue them from the brink, you know, lots of liver disease, progressing disease, heavily pretreated. What am I going to treat the patient with? They've already had pertuzumab, they've had T-DM1 and a host of other agents. And I've seen this both in ER-negative and in ER-positive disease. It's an excellent drug against the, you know, diffusely infiltrative liver metastasis, whether it be HER2-amplified or not. It's just an agent, Neil, that's quite non-cross-resistant. And this patient that I mentioned, 50 years old, is one of many in that situation. It's definitely a go-to agent in the later line HER2-amplified or HER2-normal patients.